used to the other classroom, it turns on right away. Anyway, we left off after slide 9, and slide 10 tells us two major categories of cellular work that are able to be performed at the expense of ATP. So as we said last time, ATP molecules get produced by using energy that's released from catabolic reactions when fuels get burned, and that ATP is now storing the energy that used to be in the fuel. Well, ATP is then used for a lot of different reasons, but including these two types of cellular work. There's transport work, which is better to call transmembrane transport work, because it's not just transport, it's transport through a membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. Now, not everything requires energy to do that, right? It requires external energy. There's transport through the membrane passively, but if you need to move something against its gradient, that's active transport. That is an endergonic process, and therefore you have to supply the energy. It's in the form of ATP. Then there's also mechanical work, which refers to moving things around from one place in the cell to another place in the cell. And we talked about this already before. That involves moving things along the little roadways made out of microtubules, which uses those motor proteins. And you can see here the ATP being spent. Every single step of the motor protein requires a fresh ATP molecule. So it's expensive to move things around, but you should expect that, right? Nothing moves for free. On the right side, what you see is that having spent the ATP, which means dephosphorylating it, right? You get the energy out of ATP by dephosphorylating it. That's why the used version is ADP, and you have an inorganic phosphate just in the phosphate pool on its own after it's been, I should say, partially spent, because remember, ADP still has energy in it that you could use, just not as much. Well, slide 11 illustrates the middleman function of ATP that we were talking about last time. In other words, organisms don't directly use the energy that's released by catabolism, the burning of fuels, which is exergonic, to drive the endergonic processes that the cell requires to happen. Instead, it's an indirect process. The energy released by the exergonic process of catabolizing the fuels gets captured. Some of it, not all, of course, there's going to be heat loss, but some of that gets captured by driving the phosphorylation of ADP, meaning sticking another phosphate onto ADP to make ATP. Now it's storing the energy. And usually that ATP doesn't hang around very long at all. Pretty much as soon as it's made, it then gets spent on something, some endergonic process that requires energy, and that's going to turn it back into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. So think of the adenosine nucleotides, and I say it that way to intentionally not tell you how many phosphates there are on it. Just calling them adenosine nucleotides means they could be ATP, ADP, or AMP. Think about that, though, as a pool always in the cell, a fraction of which is ATP, a fraction of which is ADP, and a fraction of which is AMP, but a small fraction of AMP. It mostly goes back and forth between ATP and ADP, shuttling the energy around. 12. This looks very familiar, hopefully. It's similar to what we looked at in the chapter on macromolecules, so there's a lot of information that's not new here, but just to show you what's going on, we have sucrose on the top. And what sort of thing is sucrose? It's a disaccharide, because it's made by hooking together two monosaccharides, glucose and fructose, with a glycosidic linkage. That's already been done, so you have table sugar at the top. And in this process, it's being split into the original two monosaccharides. So this is what kind of reaction? Right. You can see water is coming in. It's going to be hydrolysis. So you end up with glucose and fructose split apart. none of that is new information, but notice the violet color highlighting here for sucrase. Sucrase is an enzyme. So this just reinforces what I was telling you is generally true last time, just with a specific example. Effectively, all biochemical reactions are catalyzed by a specific enzyme. So this particular hydrolytic reaction is catalyzed by the enzyme called sucrase. And once again, enzymes are never put on either end of the arrow. In this case, it's to the side because the arrow is vertical. But that tells you it's not a reactant. As far as naming is concerned, there's nothing special about this example. But it does illustrate that enzyme names often, not always, but most of the time, end in A-S-E. So when you see that ending, you know you're looking at an enzyme name in biology. And also, what comes before the A-S-E usually happens one of two ways. Some enzymes get their name for what they do, like dehydrogenases, for instance, are enzymes that help to accomplish dehydrogenation reactions. Or they get their name for the substrate. And keep in mind that the substrate for any catalyzed reaction is simply the reactant. The substrate is the reactant that binds to the enzyme in order to get turned into product. In this case, the substrate is sucrose, the reactant. And so the enzyme is named sucrase to indicate that its specific substrate is sucrose. All right, 13 now. Well, here we have a graph that is once again time on the x-axis, progress of the reaction. So before and after, it goes from before to after, I should say, smoothly though. And free energy, once again, on the y-axis. So G, any individual value of y is an instantaneous value of free energy, G. And once again, if you subtract final from initial value of G, you get a value of delta G, right? So what kind of reaction are we looking at here? Just as a review, first of all, before we talk more about it. How would you classify this based on delta G? This is exergonic. Will always be true when delta G is less than zero, right? Because you end up with less free energy than you started. Therefore, the energy went down. Doesn't get destroyed. It means it's released from the system, from this reaction. So it's exergonic. That's just review. What's new information here is that for any reaction to occur, and this is a generic example, you have A and B, C and D just represent some sorts of atoms. So you have some compound A, B here and some compound C, D to start with. They get transformed by this chemical reaction into A, C and B, D. So there's a rearrangement of atoms. That occurs in any given reaction, but it's just a generic symbology. Anyway, for any reaction to occur, of course you have to go from reactants to products. But that doesn't just instantaneously happen, right? Atoms are real things. And they don't just pop into the final configuration. There is, in other words, what's called a transition state, because for the reaction to occur, certain bonds have to be broken and certain other bonds have to form in order for reactants to turn into products. And the transition state is somewhere in between reactants and products. These squiggly lines here represent bonds that are being stressed. They're on their way to being broken. And that is a very unstable situation. The transition state is very unstable. Remember, though, last time when we were looking at those three system examples, like the diving board, the gradient, and the molecule, I told you, I think, that high G corresponds to instability. And the reason processes happen is because things want to tend to lower G, which is more stable. Well, notice that the transition state has a high G. It's higher than both the products and the reactants. Okay? And it's not going to want to stay there, and it doesn't stay there long. A tiny fraction of time. But the point here is that since it's higher than the reactants and the products, the G I'm talking about, for the transition state, that really represents an energetic hill that has to be gotten over in order for this reaction to occur, even for an exergonic reaction. Now, this one is exergonic, as we just said, but I can quickly draw an example for an endergonic, or you might even already have imagined it. Even for an endergonic reaction, which would be that, you still have a transition state that is higher in G than either the final or the initial. So either way, it's a hill that has to be gotten over. Once you get to the top of that hill, the instability of that, the high G, is such that it will easily go down the other side of the hill and let it happen. But until you get to the top of that hill, this reaction isn't going to happen. This explains something I've said earlier, that even for spontaneous reactions, which is what we're looking at here, exergonic, spontaneous go hand in hand, right? They just describe different things, but an exergonic reaction is spontaneous. Even if it's spontaneous, it's not necessarily going to happen anytime soon, because it has to get over this transition state hill. And if the thermal energy of the environment is sufficient, then it will, but sometimes it's not. All right, and we give a special name for this increment of energy. Now, this increment of energy that we've already talked about, that's delta G. All right? This increment of energy, which is from the reactant energy to the transition state, is specifically called the energy of activation, or activation energy, or E sub A. All right? For any reaction to occur, whether it's exergonic or endergonic, activation energy has to be available. Because that's what gets you to the top of the hill. All right. Now notice, importantly, that activation energy does not at all depend on delta G. Delta G is not involved with activation energy at all. Delta G depends only on reactant G and product G. And activation energy is only between the peak here and the reactants. That's important because of what we see in the next slide, 14. Here we have the same exact graph, and the black trace is exactly the same thing as we saw in the previous. I didn't tell you at the time, but the black trace is how this reaction proceeds without the help of an enzyme. All right, and notice that the hill here, which is the activation energy you have to get over, is higher than the red trace. The red trace is how this reaction proceeds with the help of an enzyme. And notice the hill is much shorter and therefore easier to get over. This is how every enzyme works. Enzymes work specifically by reducing the activation energy, making the hill easier to get over. Now, there's many different ways that enzymes achieve that, but that's what every enzyme does. It decreases the value of the activation energy. And therefore, just the thermal energy will be enough, much more likely, and that's why it will go a lot faster. Now, I want to stress something I just said in the last slide, but you say it even better here. Or, well, I actually didn't say this, but it's really important about enzymes. No enzyme ever affects the value or changes the value of delta G. The value of delta G is based on the reactant and the product. And that's it. Even if an enzyme helps out, you still have the same beginning energy and ending energy, and therefore the same delta G. That is totally unaffected by the enzyme. The only thing the enzyme does is decrease E sub A, activation energy. Okay, 15. This is the same enzyme before and after binding to a substrate. And it doesn't matter what the actual example is here. This is generally true for enzymes. What we see here is pictorial representation of what is called induced fit. To induce means to bring about. And let me first remind you that anything that binds to a protein gets the general name ligand, right? We've talked about ligands binding to proteins a lot of different times. There's a lot of examples of that, like a signal to a receptor. That's an example of a ligand binding to a protein. Well, so is a substrate binding to an enzyme, because all enzymes are proteins. Okay? So you still have the same consequence here of a ligand binding to a protein, and what is that consequence? Right, there is a change in conformation. The shape of the protein changes in response to the ligand binding to it. In this case, it's the substrate binding to the enzyme. Well, first of all, the substrate is able to bind to this specific enzyme, which is another way of saying enzymes are specific for their reactions, because there's a good fit between the active site, which is the part on the enzyme where the substrate binds. It's kind of like the lock receptor, and whereas the substrate's the key. It's already a good fit, which is why this particular substrate, but not other substrates, can fit in there to begin with. But when it binds, when it goes in there and does bind to the enzyme at the active site, that changes the shape of the protein, the enzyme itself. And it changes it in such a way that it's an even better fit between the enzyme and the substrate. Kind of wraps around it. And that's why it's called induced fit, because the binding of the substrate induces an even better fit between the substrate and the enzyme. And it's kind of analogous to someone who really has a firm handshake rather than just putting out a hand without moving it, right? If you really grip the person's hand, that's kind of like what induced fit is. Which is not only a definition that's important, but the induced fit makes it kind of isolates the substrate from the surroundings better and makes the whatever the enzyme does to speed the reaction up more possible. I said a little bit earlier that enzymes accomplish the task of reducing the energy of activation in various ways depending on the particular enzyme. For instance, for the sucrase example, it could be possible, for instance, because that's not all enzymes break things apart. They just catalyze reactions. Sometimes they build things up. But in the sucrase one, that's a hydrolysis one. And so a lot of times enzymes like that would work by stressing the bonds, making them much easier to break. But if you have an enzyme that builds things up, two things come together, it might accomplish the reduction in activation energy simply by putting the two things in just the orientation, just the right orientation, so that they can react with each other. Whereas just letting them happen upon each other, it's likely that they wouldn't be in just the right orientation. Okay, 16 is a similar slide to something we saw the first time we looked at enzymes. Notice that it's drawn as a cycle. That is important because of the fact that enzymes are not reactants or products, and they therefore don't get changed into other things. And as a result, enzymes, or catalysts in general, are reusable. If you don't get your catalytic converter stolen by someone because they're valuable since they have platinum in them, you don't have to keep filling it up. The platinum is just keeps being reused because it's the catalyst. Well, here you have an enzyme being a catalyst, and it can just keep accomplishing the same job as long as there's more substrate, because you have substrate or substrates come into the active site. In this case, it's what I was just talking about. This gets them in just the right orientation with respect to each other that it makes it much more likely that they will react, and that turns them into product. That this changes the shape of the enzyme when you have the so-called enzyme-substrate complex. That's simply the combination of the enzyme and the substrate. So it's only you only call it that after the substrate has bound to the enzyme. But as we just talked about, that means the enzyme itself is in a different shape compared to when it's empty. You can see this in the cartoon. And then once the product forms, it gets released. It unbinds from the enzyme, and that leaves the enzyme, that puts it, changes its shape again back into the original shape, ready to accept more substrate if it's available. So completely reusable. By the way, this means that as long as the enzyme is present, if there is substrate, it's going to get turned into product. Last time I said that one useful thing about the fact that enzymes speed reactions up so much is that without the help of the enzyme, the reactions are so slow that they're effectively off. So this is why it's nice to be able to control an enzyme quickly. Because if as long as it is there, it's going to work. Sometimes its substrate is present, but you don't want to turn it into product. And therefore, you would either have to destroy that enzyme so it won't turn it into product, or hopefully have some way, kind of like a switch, of deactivating the enzyme. And there is such a switch, or switches possible. One of which, by the way, is phosphorylating and dephosphorylating. Phosphorylation of proteins in general acts as switches. I mentioned this when we talked about the functional groups originally. One of the many vitally important aspects of phosphate is that to phosphorylate proteins is a way to act like little switches. So enzymes can be quickly turned on or off without actually bothering to destroy them, which is expensive also because next moment you might need that enzyme, so instead of having to rebuild it, which is expensive in terms of ATP and time, you can just either phosphorylate it or dephosphorylate it, depending on the enzyme, to switch it back on. Now, more graphs are shown in 17, but this is a little bit different from what we've been looking at. They're both rate of reaction on the y-axis. So, in other words, how well the reaction is occurring, how quickly it is occurring, which means how well it is happening. But there's a black trace and a red trace in this one at the top, which is versus temperature on the x-axis. And these two red traces are the rate of the reaction of the same kind of reaction, but in two different organisms. Human for the black and a heat tolerant or thermophilic bacterium for the red. These thermophilic bacteria not only survive temperatures that would kill other organisms, they actually thrive at those temperatures. You find them in like boiling water, hot springs, Yellowstone and whatnot. But the reaction that's occurring here that the enzyme is catalyzing is the same kind of reaction in both of these organisms. Notice, though, that both of them go up to a certain point and then go down as temperature changes. Well, this is a graphic representation of something I told you originally when we were talking about acid rain. I said that environmental conditions in general can affect shapes of proteins, right? And two really important environmental variables that can drastically affect the shape of proteins is temperature and pH. Here we're looking at temperature on the top and pH on the bottom. And since temperature changes the shape of a protein, that means it's going to change how well the enzyme, which is the protein, fits the substrate, and therefore how well it acts as a catalyst to accelerate that reaction. Well, the peak on each trace is the optimum condition. So in this case, the optimum temperature. And you can see that the optimum temperature for this human enzyme is right at 38 degrees, which is the average human temperature. That's how evolution works, right? It favors the thing that works the best. So there's different versions of the enzyme that have occurred. Natural selection favored the one that occurs right at human body temperature. Get below that or above it, you sacrifice performance to some degree. And if you get way away from it, it effectively destroys the enzyme, right? The function goes to zero. Well, the heat-tolerant bacterium doesn't even really get going, working well at all, until it's way beyond the capacity of the temperature for the human. The point here is that any given enzyme has an optimal temperature, the temperature at which the shape is as the best it can be for accelerating the enzyme, accelerating the conversion of substrate to product. And the bottom traces show you that any given enzyme also has an optimum pH. In this case, though, the black and the red aren't from different organisms. They're both from humans. But they accomplish the same thing, basically, digestion, specifically breaking down starch. But you have different enzymes doing that in different parts of the body. This one, the black one, occurs in the stomach, which is at very low pH, pH of 2 or lower because of all the hydrochloric acid. And this particular version of the enzyme does well right there at stomach pH. After the contents, which is called the chyme at that point, it's no longer food, it's chyme, it gets sent to the small intestine and undergoes a drastic change in pH because the small intestine isn't at that high acidity. So this enzyme that was working in the stomach basically just quits working as soon as it leaves the stomach because the pH is way too high now. And the same job is taken over by a different enzyme that's in the small intestine that has an optimal pH of intestinal pH, equal to the intestinal pH. Okay, 18. Everything we've been talking about so far with respect to enzymes and substrates binding is illustrated in this first of these three pictures, this so-called normal binding, meaning that the only particles involved are the substrate and the enzyme itself. Right? You have an active site, a substrate of the right kind, but only the right kind, is able to fit into that active site, and that allows for conversion of substrate to product. That's normal binding. But we also have in B what is called competitive inhibition. Now, first of all, inhibition refers to shutting down. I was talking about controlling enzymes earlier. Well, when you control an enzyme, there's two ways you can do that. You can either shut it down or turn it on, activate it or inhibit it. Here we have competitive inhibition. And that's not the only kind of inhibition. But competitive inhibition is specifically inhibition or turning off of the enzyme by some sort of particle other than the substrate binding in the active site instead of the substrate doing that. In other words, the other particle, which is called the competitive inhibitor, blocks the active site. So even though there's substrate might be around, it can't get in there, and therefore it won't get turned into product. The inhibitor effectively takes that particular enzyme. There's many, many copies of the same enzyme. But this particular enzyme, for the moment, at least as long as that competitive inhibitor is in the active site, that enzyme might as well not be there. It's turned off. And therefore, it won't turn anything into product. The competitive inhibitor is not a substrate. It doesn't get turned into anything. It simply has the right shape to block the active site. And that is why it's called competitive inhibition. Because these two particles, the substrate itself and the inhibitor, are both competing for the same place on the enzyme. They're competing for the active site. You also can have, though, non-competitive inhibition. That's what's shown in C. What makes this non-competitive inhibition is that the inhibitor, which is the reddish thing, is binding to the enzyme some other place other than the active site. The active site is still open. So why would that work? If it's not the active site where the inhibitor is binding, why would the binding somewhere else on the protein still cause inhibition? Exactly. The inhibitor is a ligand, and so the same thing we keep saying. And a ligand binding to a protein changes the shape. In this case, the shape changes so much that the active site is open, but it's no longer the right shape for the substrate. And so the substrate is there, just cannot get in. They didn't draw this really well because it looks like it will still fit in there pretty easily, but it can't. All right? And as long as that non-competitive inhibitor is there, this enzyme is taken out of the game as well. But if it unhooks the inhibitor, then the shape of the protein will go into its normal unbound shape, which will have the right active site, correctly shaped active site, and the substrate can then bind. All right, that's part of control. That's just the turning off aspect of control of enzymes. That's the inhibition. And so this would be by analogy with electronic circuits, this would be a normally on enzyme that you could turn off. Some enzymes, though, are normally off and have to be turned on before they operate. Slide 19 illustrates this. By the way, another word for non-competitive inhibition is allosteric inhibition. Allosteric inhibition involves the binding of an inhibitor somewhere other than the active site. Now, really, a more general phrase is allosteric control, because an allosteric particle can either inactivate, inhibit, in other words, or activate an enzyme, depending on the particular enzyme. But think about this. Does it make sense to you that if it's a competitive control, it would have to be inhibition? It doesn't make sense to think about competitive activation, right? You see why that makes sense? For it to be competitive means something is binding into the active site. Well, that's never going to activate the enzyme, right? It's only going to block the substrate. So all competitive control is inhibition. But allosteric control, which is by binding of the particle to somewhere other than the active site, that can be either inhibitory or activational, depending on the particular enzyme, and depending on the particle, really. So here we have a Multimeric enzyme. It's a protein with multiple polypeptides. Each of these subunits is one polypeptide. And so it's really, in this case, cartoon case, four enzymes in one, because each subunit has its own active site. Okay? But notice that this, notice these oscillation arrows. This is one shape that it can this protein can have without binding to anything. And this is another shape. And they're, both of those shapes are about the same G value, meaning neither of them is really favored. So just because of fluctuations in the heat as particles move around, this unbound, nothing bound to it, enzyme just goes back and forth between these two shapes. And notice that in only one of these shapes is the active site correctly shaped for the substrate to fit in. This one, the active sites are all deformed. So without any binding of anything to it, the enzyme's just going back and forth between effective and ineffective. But then you have these green things, green in the cartoon, called activators. Those are allosteric particles that will bind, if they're present, somewhere other than the active site. This is not an active site right here. These are the active sites. So it's binding here, and that will basically keep this enzyme from flipping back and forth between forms. It'll lock it into this active form, meaning the form that has the correctly shaped active sites. And therefore, if substrate is there, it will easily be transformed into product. So that would be an allosteric activator because it turns the enzyme on. This red thing is an allosteric inhibitor, though. It also binds somewhere other than the active site, but in this case, the way it binds is to lock it into the inactive form, lock the enzyme into the inactive form. And so that will keep it turned off. And those are both useful things, right? Because the more control a cell has over its biochemical pathways and the individual reactions in those pathways, the better. Notice the substrate can only bind if it's locked into the stabilized form. All right, 20. Here we have a kind of a flowchart notation to illustrate what is called feedback inhibition. Feedback is really important in homeostasis. We've already talked about this early on in the course, right? We talked about positive feedback, negative feedback. Which of those feedback types is more prevalent? Negative, because only negative feedback can ever lead to homeostasis, right? But it's called feedback in this enzyme case, or enzyme and biochemical pathway case, because something gets fed back to an earlier part of the process. So we have a generic, well, actually, it's not generic. We have an example pathway where the initial substrate, what you start with, is threonine. You go through several steps in the pathway, as pathways by definition involve multiple individual reactions, each feeding the next. You eventually get to the end product, which is isoleucine, and that example doesn't matter. The point here is that you have a biochemical pathway made up of some number of individual reactions. And that pathway exists, so it's, you know, if you have threonine, what you need at the beginning, there's the potential for it to be turned into isoleucine stepwise, but that's only going to happen anytime soon if you have the help of the individual enzymes along the way, right? So the control I'm talking about is if you have threonine but you really don't want it to convert it into anything, then you need a way to turn this pathway off. And when would be appropriate to turn it off? Well, when you don't need any more of the end product that gets converted into, which is the isoleucine. Okay, so think about this in terms of error, which we talked about in feedback generally before. Negative feedback is required when there is an error, right? An error is some difference between what is there at the moment and what should be. Well, the error in this case, well, let's, before we get to the error, if the cell does need isoleucine, then it's appropriate to have this pathway running. And so if it does need it, threonine will, and all these enzymes are activated, threonine will get converted stepwise into isoleucine. That isoleucine will be used for whatever purpose the cell needs it for as it's being produced. And therefore, if the cell continues to need it, isoleucine is not going to build up. It's going to be used as it's produced. So it's going to continue in that case to be the case that more isoleucine is needed, and therefore it would be appropriate to keep this pathway turned on. Eventually, though, the cell has as much as it needs isoleucine. And therefore, if this pathway continues to run, which it will for a little bit, isoleucine will build up, being unused. And that is the error. The error is you have too much isoleucine at the moment. Okay? Well, that's where the feedback inhibition comes in, which is negative feedback. Isoleucine itself serves as an allosteric regulator, just like the red and green things in the previous one. Isoleucine, if it starts to build up, will bind to the enzyme number one in the pathway allosterically, not at the active site, but somewhere else. And that will deform the active site so that it takes enzyme one out of the game. It deactivates enzyme one. And it usually is the case, not for just this example, but for any biochemical pathway, that the enzyme that gets turned off in this way is the first one in the pathway. Why does that make sense? Because notice, you could turn off any one of these enzymes and the whole pathway would get shut down, right? Because you couldn't get past that point. Why does it make sense for the cell to want to shut it down at enzyme one rather than one of the other enzymes? In both cases, you're no longer producing isoleucine, which is appropriate, right? Because you already have enough. But it makes sense to shut it down up here because then you aren't going through the unnecessary and wasteful process of producing all these intermediates when you don't really want the whole thing to run, right? So you shut it off at the beginning. And notice that that's automatic. The cell doesn't have to know anything. It simply turns off immediately when isoleucine starts building up, which is the appropriate time to shut down production of further isoleucine. But that stockpile of isoleucine will eventually be needed by the cell again, so it starts using it. The isoleucine gets rarer and rarer, and therefore has a greater likelihood of detaching from the enzyme 1 and being used by the cell. And that, as soon as you unbind it from the enzyme, that will put it back into its original shape, so it has the active site correctly shaped to fit threonine, and this pathway will automatically turn back on. That is negative feedback at the level of an enzyme working, and it's allosteric regulation. That's that chapter. Let me switch to quarters.